Hey, welcome to the Wildscast. Just finished a fascinating conversation with Dr. Sheila Nazarian. Dr. Sheila is a plastic surgeon in LA, graduate of Columbia University, Einstein School of Medicine, but she's also become a huge advocate for Israel, defending the state of Israel, particularly since October the 7th. We spoke about a number of important topics, including getting a gun. Is it time for American Jews to get guns? Why did it take so long on October 7th to, why did it take, excuse me, October 7th for a lot of American Jews and Jews throughout the world to wake up, unfortunately, to the unfortunate, you know, increase in anti-Semitism happening in the world? And I asked her also a question, would you treat a terrorist medically? Because we know that doctors in Israel do this routinely, but would you do this? I asked her. And I wanted to get her particular perspective, not only on that question, but just on Israel in general, because Dr. Sheila escaped Iran as a child, and therefore she has a unique set of opinions and perspectives of someone who was raised in a country, in a Muslim country, and came to the West, who came to the United States. And I think it's important, particularly for many of us Ashkenazim that were born in the United States, whose parents and grandparents are all from this great country, to hear the perspective of someone coming from a Muslim country who had to escape and come here. So tune in to hear Dr. Sheila Nazarian, amazing conversation. And of course, please like, comment, and subscribe to this channel to see more Wildcasts. I have the great honor of interviewing Dr. Nazarian, Sheila Nazarian. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much.
It's really an honor and a pleasure. Thanks for joining the Wildscast. You shared an Instagram post recently about really celebrating your Jewish Iranian ancestry or heritage. Tell us a little about your Exodus story, if you will.
Yeah, sure. Never heard it called that, but I love it. So I was actually born in New York in Long Island as an anchor baby. My mom, when she was 9 months pregnant, flew from Iran to New York. So I would be a U.S. citizen. Went back shortly thereafter. We had a whole life there. You know, my dad was the head of the Shah's Heart Hospital. We had a comfortable, you know, three-story, all marble home, as you can imagine the Persians live in. And, you know, shortly thereafter, in 1980, the Iran-Iraq war started. There was missiles flying into Tehran, very similar to what we see flying into Israel right now. The sirens would go off in the middle of the night. We'd run to the windows, and my mom would tell us to watch the fireworks, quote unquote. We could kind of see where the Islamist government was heading. My parents quickly realized that it was probably not going to be a good place to raise their two daughters. And so they started planning an escape. Now, Jews weren't allowed to leave. We were stuck, even though there was, you know, aggression towards us and we weren't able to really practice our religion freely. They didn't want us to go either.
And this is, what year is this now? We're talking...
This is 1985, 86. Mm-hmm. So my dad was a physician, obviously, and said that he was going to a medical conference. And so they let him go, but they kept me, my mom, and my sister's passport so that we wouldn't leave. One day, my mom took me and my sister to the bazaar, and we got into the back of this truck in like the fetal position, puzzle pieced together with some strangers. They put burlap sacks on top of us with corn.
Oh, my God.
That's how we started heading towards the border between Iran and Pakistan.
And you're how old? How old are you now?
I was six at that time, like six.
You're six. And your parents were leaving because of the war? Or because it was just too unsafe for Jews to stay there?
I think it was too unsafe. My dad just describes feeling unsafe every day. You know, just feeling unease, unsafe, didn't know what the future held. Definitely could see the clamping down on women's freedoms and was just like, this is not it. We need to get out. And a lot of our family had already left. You know, we were kind of the last ones there because my paternal grandmother was older. We had to get her out. So First we got her into Israel for medical treatment. And then once she was out, then, you know, we started planning our escape. We weren't just going to leave her.
Jews were starting to leave after the revolution, I assume, in 1979.
Before the revolution. Yeah, even before the revolution, a lot of people left in 78 when they could kind of, you know, smell what was happening. The Baha'is left even earlier. They were leaving in 75.
And it was, I mean, it was that bad because you'd be risking, you know, your family would have to start over. You just said you lived in this beautiful palatial home.
Yeah. I mean, everybody had to start over. There's so many people that are here that were engineers in Iran, and they come here and, you know, they open up cleaners.
Right, right.
You know, just starting literally all over in a new language, new culture, new profession, like new everything.
Wow. I mean,
how does it have to be? You have to put yourself in the shoes of these people in their 30s and 40s, completely upending their comfortable lives to move to a country that is completely foreign. How bad does it have to be? Like, you can kind of imagine the answer to that question.
Do you feel, I mean, if you don't mind me just jumping in, I know you're in the middle of telling your personal story. I mean, do you feel like anything like what you experienced as a child or what your parents went through that caused them to want to flee Iran and come to the United States? Do you feel like some of that is in the air now in the United States post October 7th?
Not just post October 7th, Rabbi, it's been here. I've been screaming this from the hills for 4 or 5 years now. And it's shocking to me that it took October 7th to get most Jews to wake up.
Yeah.
Like, where have you been? Have you just had your head in the sand? Like, where were you? You know, and I always think, like, and this is terrible to say, and I'd love your opinion on it. I mean, it's terrible to say, but I think it's true. Is what was your religion before October 7th? Was it progressivism? Was it fitting in? Was it assimilation? What was your religion pre-October 7th that all of a sudden you've woken up to your Judaism? You know, where were you?
Well, I'm thrilled if people are woken up to their Judaism, at least. You know,
it's sad. Like, why do we forget? Where is our memory? Like, everyone talks about this passed down trauma, you know, especially in the Ashkenazi world from the Holocaust and the Shoah, obviously. Where was that? Now, all of a sudden, you're passed down trauma. Like, you remember.
No, we forget.
Talking about it for a long time about your passed down trauma, but you forgot what led to that. Like, where, I just you can explain it to me, because I'm a first generation Persian Jew. We have not forgotten.
Right.
We're like the loudest, proudest, holding people to account, but it's because we just left and we're first generation. Maybe that's it.
I think that's it because I can give you a number of instances in Jewish history where within a span of 70 years, we forget, completely forget. First of all, Purim, the Jewish people became so assimilated into your ancient society, Persian society.
Yep.
They were worshiping God around the temple in Jerusalem, King Solomon's temple. Babylonians destroyed it. 70 years later, they're at a party with Ahasuerus against the Edict of Mordechai, who's telling people, don't go to the party. They're celebrating the end of Jewish history. They went anyway.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is happening. And, you know,
question for you, do you think the progressive Jews of today are in that same lot where they're celebrating the end of Jews? By marching with Black Lives Matter, who had anti-Semitism in their charter. By marching at the Women's March, when Linda Sarsour is on stage, talking about intersectionality and bashing Israel on stage at a Women's March. What is that very similar? How do you read that?
I mean, I think that it's ignorance. I don't think, I mean, I have students and friends and people a little more on the left. I don't have too many hard left, you know, colleagues and friends like that. But I think they're just, unfortunately, the progressive values became woke values. And the wokeism is steeped in this intersectionality, as you just said, which makes anyone who's a victim having the moral high ground. And therefore, Israel is the oppressor now. But I don't think that's like anti-Semitism. Like, I don't think that's coming from a place, I hate the Jew, or I'm Jewish and I hate my own religion. I just think, unfortunately, they've gotten co-opted into the ideology of this generation. And that ideology happens to be, you know, championing the victim. And the more white Jews are successful, the more we're going to be seen as some sort of oppressive. And out of that, I mean, it's terrible. It's terrible. And maybe on some level, it doesn't really matter. You know, I just don't like calling fellow Jews anti-Semites if I don't have to.
Oh, no, I'm not calling them anti-Semites. I'm calling them forgetful of their religion, their roots, and who they are, and what it has taken for Jews
it's three
to build.
It's
I
three,
don't think
four.
They're anti-Semites.
Yeah.
I mean, that doesn't even kind of make sense to me. It's like,
right.
These people are anti themselves, I guess. I don't know. It's not that.
Yeah.
It's I think it's more not like secretive, but it's like more undertoned than just, oh, you're an anti. That's it's worse than that. It's like
Yeah.
you forgot who you are. You
Yeah.
forgot where you come from. You forgot your roots. You forgot your history, and you've allowed an alternative religion to replace your Judaism, which, by the way, is in your DNA and shows up on your genetic testing, and you can't refute it.
Yeah. Yeah, but it is being refuted. And I think you're the difference between you and a lot of our American Jewish brothers and sisters. They've been here three, four generations. And I don't think many of them have studied. I mean, I can tell you they haven't studied Jewish history because so many young people don't know modern day Israeli history. Okay, how many people are actually aware of the fact that in 2005, Israel vacated the Gaza Strip? And literally against the will of about 7,000 Jews, pulled them out of their homes. And now we're some sort of occupying, we weren't occupying the Gaza Strip, but very few people are aware of that. If you get your history from TikTok, that's what's going to happen,
But it's
unfortunately.
not just that, Mark. And again, I'm coming from a person who lived under oppressive
Right.
Islamist ideology and government. Okay. Did it work? Like, was giving up the Gaza Strip and the West Bank to appease and to, did it work? Was it the right move? You know, where do we go from here?
Right.
You know,
Well,
and
I don't think anyone in Israel believes, you know, I remember the Oslo Accords in 1993, and they had Jordan, they had a peace treaty with Jordan and Egypt, which kind of demonstrated that if you cede with some territory and you have the right government and the right leaders. Now, Saddam Hussein took a bullet because of that.
Yeah, it's not the
Not
right.
Saddam Hussein, excuse me, Anwar Sadat.
Yes,
In,
Adat, yeah.
yeah.
But what I'm trying to say is, in order to have something like that work, you need to have a person on the other side that is culturally and educationally and morally aligned with this common
Right.
core values of
Right.
peace, life, thriving population. Right. So
Right.
right now, when people say, oh, two-state solution, I wrote an article about this. It's literally a delusional, right? Because you want to, there's this book called Tribal Leadership. It's a business book, and it talks about office culture, business culture. And so there's five stages of business culture. So if someone's at the bottom stage where it's described as the world is about, like, the world sucks, not just my life sucks, but the world sucks. You can't walk into an office culture like that and be like, hey guys, we're going to kill it. We're going to like do so well today. You can't talk to
Right,
somebody at that
right.
level of culture. You have to get them step by step up the ladder of culture in order to be able to have that like pep talk with them.
Right.
Right. So right now, when their culture is literally, and their entire identity is around killing Jews, martyrdom, death, you know, all of this stuff, how are you going to give them a two-state when they don't even recognize Israel, where they
Yeah.
constantly want to
Yeah.
repeat October 7th? Like, what are you talking about? It's going to take 10 to 20 years of re-educating, de-radicalizing, like was done to the Nazi youth after World War II, then let's talk about a two-state solution. So it brings us back to the idea of giving land to people that want you dead and don't even recognize your side of the land.
Yeah.
It's like, what are you talking about?
Because they have no other alternative. The idea that Israel will just control the land themselves is an
No,
anathema.
I don't think they should.
You
So what
know.
do you do in business when you need help? You bring in experts, you bring in allies, right? What about splitting the area up for a while between Saudi, Emirates, you know, Jordan, redoing their curriculum, raise the youth up to understand and to recognize Israel and know that Jews aren't your enemy and that you have a future. You can thrive. You know, you will have opportunities. You will have an opportunity to feed your family and grow and thrive and become a business person. You know, then 20 years from now, two-state solution.
I totally agree. If you don't change the mentality, then the prospect of any kind of reconciliation with our Arab neighbors is a complete, and for the president or anyone to propose that while this is going on, But let me ask you, let's go back to your story because, and I know we jumped away. No, but this was very relevant because whenever I speak to my Persian friends, or and I speak to, or especially their parents or grandparents who had to flee themselves, or I talk to other Sephardi friends of mine, okay, they get the mentality in a way that Ashkenazi, quote unquote, more enlightened, better educated. I know I'm speaking to a physician here, but you know,
that brings me to another thing that I love that you brought up. You know, when we first came to America, I remember being at a graduation, a high school graduation in Los Angeles, and the Ashkenazi Jews turned around to the Persian Jews and said, go back to your own country. There is that sort of, you know, no, what you just said is very relevant, but it's so crazy to me that after October 7th, I wrote this article for Tablet magazine that says, listen to Jews who don't look, act, or vote like you.
And it
went nuts. And I had female rabbis from New York with an LGBTQ flag behind them with a Star of David in the middle of it calling me, being like, we want you to come speak to our congregation. We're ready to listen to you.
Wow.
You know, so it's again, that's like another silver lining, but very belated, you know, after October 7th, where people are like, oh, maybe these Jews that fleed these socialist slash Islamist slash communist countries, you know, Russia, South America, you know, Cuba.
Right, because there is a certain political orientation that Russian Jews have.
Politics. Yeah, right. We can't get away from politics here because, you know, the Ashkenazi Jews, whether it's correct or not at this point in time, are traumatized by the verbiage of the right? Because of the Holocaust, they think of it as white supremacy, nationalism, things like that. I think things have shifted very much so on the Democrat side and certainly on the Republican side, right? But, you know, all the rest of us Jews that escaped the socialism, we're traumatized by the verbiage of the left. So we don't understand how anyone can be a left person at all. We're like, no, we've smelled this before. We don't want to smell this again. We know where this is headed, right? But it's interesting. I just spoke to a congressperson on the left who's very Zionist, and he said it's very dangerous and scary to be a Zionist on the left right now.
Oh, yeah.
He said himself, it is very accepted and not dangerous to be a Zionist on the right.
Well, you have Christian evangelicals. You have some other friends over there.
But it's very accepted to think of Israel as an ally on the right. And to respect Jews. Who's holding the university presidents to account right now? Is it the Democrats?
No,
it's all Republicans in Congress asking them the tough questions, suing the schools, bringing them in front of
Congress. So let me ask you a question while we're on politics then. What would you do? Because you know it's not good for Israel. It's not good for Israel's health to be a bipartisan issue, to be only supported by Republican conservatives.
And I want to make it very clear. I will support a Democrat and even donate to their campaign if they're not crazy. You know, because I know some states will not be swinging right now. I know some districts will never vote in a Republican. So we're going to support the Democrat who is sane, right?
And do you think there's enough, not only sanity, but enough of a strong, you know, moderate Democrat, I'm calling moderate Democrats, people that are not, you know, far on the left, that will actually silence the far left of the Democratic Party?
I mean,
I know Schumer and the others haven't, you know.
I haven't seen it. And it comes off as cowardice. It comes off as weak. And it's shameful and honestly immoral. That's what they're presenting themselves as right now.
Yeah, it's a shame. You know, I worked for two members of Congress before I became a rabbi. One was my Congressman Gary Ackerman. He should live and be well. Liberal Democrat from my district in Queens. And I used to do Soviet jury work for him. This is back in high school and college. And then I worked for Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, a blessed memory. Now, Daniel said also liberal, progressive liberal. He was the one that defeated the Zionism as racism bill that was proposed in the United Nations in the late 70s, early 80s. And it's unbelievable how things have shifted so much because these guys, I used to see them going out to lunch and they were friends with Republicans, with conservatives, with liberals. People had certain collegiality. They had certain respect for each other. Do you think there's a chance to get back to that? Or it's just like, because a lot of Jews are just saying, oh, Democratic Party done for Jews. If you're pro-Israel, you can't vote Democrat anymore. I mean, do you feel that we've reached that point, or no, we have to.
I think right now, as it stands, when you look at the policies of, you know, both sides, I think that's right now in this point in time, it stands true. I do. And it's interesting to me, you know, I've gone into Instagram, you know, DM fights and all this stuff with other very progressive Jews who, after October 7th, themselves posted, I will never be voting for a Democrat ever again.
Wow.
People that were literally like keyboard warrioring me and like, so, I think October 7th made it undeniable. And it's so, it's upsetting to me that it takes something like that to get people to like open their eyes
to wake up a
and,
little.
And they're so emotional about it. You know, they're so like sad about it and devastated.
Well, it's like you touched on it before. It is and has become, people's political views have become almost their religious value system.
So it's almost like their religion blew up. Yeah.
Yeah. And what's happening?
Too, I'll tell you another story. So days after October 7th, I went to Bring Them Home Now fundraiser. And I spoke before, I'm standing at the podium. Okay. Imagine this. And there's these three, four families who literally, one of them, his wife and two daughters are held hostage. Another one saw his dad get killed and his nephew and cousin are held hostage. And another woman whose best friend is held hostage, right? I'm on stage speaking before they're speaking. And I said, basically what I just said to you on this podcast, why didn't you listen to us? We were telling you these people are not partners in peace. These people were living in Be'eri. They were flying kites next to the Gaza border, driving cancer patients from Gaza into Israeli hospitals every day. And after I sat down, I was like, oh my gosh, was I too harsh? Like, was this the appropriate thing to say 5 days after October 7th, right? And the first person stood up and he said, you know what? Judaism was not our religion. Peace was our religion, and our religion has been shattered.
Wow. Wow. It's sad.
Yeah.
It's sad. Not that the religion has been shattered, but that the certain naivete, and, you know, Rabbi Soloveitchik has a very fascinating article. I just studied it with my class. Mm-hmm. And he said, we were the ones to bring the belief in the inherent goodness of mankind. We brought that idea out because we believe in the neshama and the soul. But one of the lessons of the Purim story is that we cannot allow our belief in the goodness of man, of people, to make us naive to the satanic possibilities of people.
I will take it further and say it's not just naive, it's narcissistic to think that everyone shares the same core values that you share. It's not just naive.
Yeah. We met with my wife and I went to, we were in Kfar Aza about a month after October 7th, and we met with a woman also very involved in the peace movement with Gazans. And felt so, you know, how betrayed she felt. And, you know, this is not the time.
It's not the time, but it is the time. It's not the time to say you were wrong, you were whatever, but it is the time to recognize mistakes and to learn from them and to move forward with them close to our hearts. And to understand, you know, this whole idea of tikkun olam starts at home. You heal your home first before you go out and try to heal the community and then the beyond the community.
Well, I always said I'm writing a basic Judaism book for Koren, and I have a section on Tikkun Olam. And everybody basically chops that phrase from the larger verse.
Right.
We say it in our Aleinu prayer every day, L'takein Olam b'malchut Shakai, that our job as Jews is to perfect the world under the kingdom of God, which means using Jewish values. So if you try to make the world better using some foreign value, okay, you may think in some kind of misguided way you're making things better, but you actually might be setting things back. So I have a couple of examples of, and we don't have to get into them right now, of, you know, some of the best and well-intentioned people out there, Jews and non-Jews alike, are trying to do good, but with a misguided set of values. And wow. What's going on in the medical profession? You are a surgeon. You have a lot of medical colleagues. Have they been supportive of your advocacy on behalf of Israel? Have you gotten pushback from some of the people you work with?
I will tell you that I have learned in the last 4 years of Israel advocacy that you cannot have people be obsessed with you unless you have people who hate you, and that's okay. So I will tell you, the vast majority of people who speak to my face are extremely supportive to the point of tears. And I will tell you, I'm sure there's many people who, you know, disagree. And
they're not so vocal, though, you're
saying. They're not so vocal to my face. But I mean, you know, the reason why partially I started going nuts 3 years ago in support of Israel on my social media is because I was seeing my colleagues posting lies like apartheid, genocide,
right,
years
right.
ago. And I said, you know what? I have more followers than you. Watch me go.
And so, where are you getting your sort of inspiration or moral guidance from?
You know, I think that when I first started posting after the May 2021 conflict, you know, I was posting before that, but I really just, my whole feed went for Israel at that point. It was this core guttural need to defend Israel and my people 8 hours a day, in addition to my job, in addition to being a mom of three and a wife. And when I look back on it, I think it really is survival. You know, my family risked everything to bring us to America. We cannot let America go down. We need Israel, and Israel needs the diaspora. And
wow.
I just, you know,
wow.
felt that it was my honoring of my parents to fully take advantage of my freedom of speech and freedom of thought in America, which they risked everything to bring me to.
What would you say your primary motivation is? Is it to save Jews, or is it to save America from itself?
I think it's number one. I think it's to save the future of my own children as a mother. Number two, I think it's to, you know, save Jews in America. I think, you know, if America goes down, like, what are we all going to do? Go to like Israel, all of us. And
right. But that's what I'm curious about. Is it because we won't have this great country anymore to live in? Because we have Israel, we have to, or
yeah,
is
we
it
have
that
Israel, but imagine we're all in Israel, you know, all it takes is one nuclear bomb. Like, I don't think that's a
I mean,
good
that's,
idea either.
Yeah, but that's where the rabbi part of me would probably jump in and say,
jump in, make me feel better.
I mean, you have to have some, not you, but
yeah,
you know, a lot of people have said that to me, Rabbi, it's so dangerous for all the Jews to be congregated in Israel. And yet that's what the Torah wants. The Torah doesn't promote Jews living in the diaspora. The Torah promotes all Jews living in Israel. Whatever reasons we're living here, whatever legitimate or not legitimate reasons for living outside of Israel, the vision of the Torah is clearly for all Jews to be living. So clearly, from a divine biblical perspective, you know, but I guess what I was asking about before, and I'll tell you why in a minute,
yeah,
is how much do you feel as an American Jew, you know, living in you know, coming from Iran, coming to the United States, do you feel that you should try to be saving the culture in America too? Because I have a lot of friends that are like, the heck with the American culture. I'm a Jew first, and I just want to save Jews or Israel. So if it's good for Jews, I'll stay here. If it's not, we're out of here. I'll tell you why. I saw a letter. Mm-hmm. One of my teachers, Rabbi Dr. Jacob J. Schachter, he's a big scholar at Yeshiva University. He helped me start MGE. He read to me a letter that his father of blessed memory wrote to his parents, explaining to them why he wanted to join the American army in 1942. He was a rabbi and had a nice cushy rabbi job in Stamford, Connecticut, but he saw what was happening in Europe. But in that letter, it was a 5-page letter written to his parents in Hebrew. He says the number one reason is because the United States has such ideals that are so consistent with Torah that he wants to keep the United States, you know, free from Nazism and from oppression. And number two, our brothers and sisters, look what's happening. You know, they didn't know everything yet, you know, at that time, but he knew enough of what was going on to Europe's Jews. He wanted to, and he ended up joining, becoming a chaplain. And he was the famous rabbi chaplain that liberated Buchenwald, saved Rabbi Israel Meir Lau, who later became Israel's chief rabbi. But I was sitting with 70 other rabbis. I couldn't believe that the first priority was to save America. And I'm just wondering if there any Jews left like that.
I mean, I'm so, you know, I'm so pro America. I am like so grateful to be here. I'm very like, I don't know. I think we do need to save America. You don't know. Like, I have a huge American flag in my front yard. I moved my kids from a Jewish school to a public school. And the first day of public school, they stood up, they faced the American flag, they said the Pledge of Allegiance with the word God in it. And I said, I'm in the right place. So I am very grateful to America. I'm very happy to be here. And I think it's me personally, I think it's integral to the survival of Israel. And I think they're so deeply intertwined in so many ways. And it is a Judeo-Christian country. So it totally makes sense that in this letter, he said, you know, the values are so aligned with Torah because it was based on Judeo-Christian values.
Yeah, you recorded a PragerU video called I Am Proof That the American Dream is Alive. I'm asking this because, you know, when I speak to a lot of my friends and colleagues, not necessarily my students come from a much more broad range, conservative, reform, unaffiliated.
Yeah.
But when I speak to my Orthodox friends that I grew up with, they're like, Mark, you know, you got a couple of years left there. See who you can pull on the lifeboat and bring to Israel with you. But the American, you know, experiment for Jews is starting to be over.
I disagree. I actually just went on Adam Carolla's podcast and he told me that he travels the US 5 times a year. And he says he definitely sees a shift back to kind of the values that started this country and why everyone loves to be an American. So I feel a lot less lonely now than I did after 21 when I first started posting.
Right. Tell us a little about just what we touched on Judaism a little. How has your Judaism inspired your medical career?
Oh my gosh. I mean, I think that, you know, I'll tell you, we were very traditional. Like we weren't, you know, going to temple every week. We weren't, you know, we did the Yom Kippur thing. We did Shabbat dinners with our family very consistently, very much like Thanksgiving. I didn't go to Hebrew school. I cannot read Hebrew. My bat mitzvah was me going with my mom to Israel, going in front of the Wailing Wall and having a rabbi bless my head.
that's kind of pathetic, no offense.
I'm telling you, I didn't know a lot of, you know, Jewish history until I had to defend it on Instagram 4 years ago, which is horrible. Don't do what I did. Learn your roots, you know. Way before that, I would say, you know, we had good, strong Persian Jewish values in my house. My father was a physician. Taking care of people and helping people was something I always wanted to do. I didn't know the words tikkun olam until my own kids went to Jewish school. So I just think we were raised to be good people that wanted to help others and also wanted to honor God in the sense that we were blessed with certain skills and talents and intelligence. And to be lazy with that was not something that was acceptable. Right. It's like spitting in God's face. You don't do that.
No.
You take all your blessings and you go do wonders in the world for, you know, yourself, for your family and for others.
That's beautiful.
I think that that's sort of, you know, I didn't like think every morning, how does my Judaism make me want to be a doctor?
Right.
Like that wasn't it, you know?
Right. No, you know, you should get, I don't know if you've ever seen, you know, the special tefillah. I have a couple of doctor friends. They start their mornings by reciting the special prayer that Maimonides, who of course was a great physician, wrote. And it's so gorgeous. You would love it. I'll see if I can
find
a copy.
I have it on my wall. Gave it to me.
Well known. And it's, you know, it also maintains a certain humility. Not that you have this issue, but there are some doctors that can get a bit.
No, trust me. I'm pitching
arrogant.
A show right now called God Complex.
Talking
about how doctors lose their way. So I'm very acutely aware.
You know, this is going to sound terrible, but you know, the guy who goes to heaven, and this guy's, you know, this one of the angels is taking him around and showing him the different, you know, and he keeps seeing this other guy with a stethoscope and like a long white coat.
Yeah.
And he's like, who is that guy I keep seeing? He goes, oh, that's God. Sometimes he thinks he's a doctor. You know,
that's
the old
funny.
Bad joke. You just mentioned about a series that you're pitching, but you have an Emmy nominated Netflix series called Skin Decision. Tell us what has that done for you? I don't mean materially.
No, I mean, it was, you know, I think it's very much exactly how I wanted to represent myself in the world. I had a very successful medical practice before the show. I wasn't trying to be, you know, a clown. I wasn't trying to make fun of people. I was really trying to do a docu-style series on why people get plastic surgery, You know, whether it was they were shot by their husband or they had quadruplets and it ruined them, you know, their self-esteem, and they haven't, their husband hasn't seen them in the bedroom for 4 years, you know, like, so it was a very classy, well-done show, and it was like a typhoon for my practice. It you know, obviously grew my Instagram as well, but I had a sizable Instagram before that. But I think what it did for my advocacy is that it helped me speak to outside of the echo chamber. So we see a lot of, you know, pro-Israel accounts, but they're speaking to, you know, people who agree with them for the most part. I have tons of followers in Brazil and the Philippines and all over the world. And so it really gave me a unique platform to reach people that maybe have never even met a Jew. And so again, we're pitching another one now, just trying to grow that reach and trying to educate the masses, which has always been such a passion of mine. Like me with my patients one-on-one is fantastic, but being able to really reach the world is something that I think is, you know, legacy building.
And just on that, on the whole, not speaking, within an echo chamber and really being able to get your message out to people, what happens then when, I mean, because I have this on my own Instagram account, when you get just the nasty, disgusting things being posted, I don't mean just Free Palestine, but like, beyond that, what do
So,
you, yeah, what
yeah,
do you
in the
do?
beginning
And
in 21, you know, I was just replying to everybody and like, you know, spending 8 hours a day on my phone and all this stuff. Now what I do is, you know, if they're following me, I just restrict them. So they're just talking to themselves. Essentially, no one can see their comments. If they're not following me and they post a nasty comment, I just block them. So I just don't waste my time. For me, it's really about getting as much information out there as possible. Occasionally, when someone's like unfollowing, you know, I use it as an opportunity to show my class or wittiness, or so I'll be like, you know, this isn't the airport, you don't have to announce your departure. Or they'll post something and I'll actually reply, and I don't know, I try to show like either how cool I am or how witty I am or how professional I am or how intelligent I am. And so I use it as an opportunity, and I'll actually take that post and pin it to the top, or I'll just make it a whole feed post if it's good enough. And people love it because it empowers them to not be weak. You know, they're like, oh, Sheila can, you know, come back like this. You know, maybe I can start speaking up too.
Are you concerned at all just with the any physical violence, anti-Semitism? I'd mentioned I came back from a rabbinic conference and I became a little friendly with a rabbi from Providence, Rhode Island. Okay, he's got eight professors from Brown in his synagogue, and he says he no longer feels comfortable wearing a kippah in public. He's an Orthodox rabbi, he has something on his head. But are you feeling that? And what do you say?
Rabbi, I'm always armed. I have a gun on me right now. I feel very empowered. The NRA has reposted me 3 times. I'm very proud of my exercising my Second Amendment. I have tasers in my office as well as home. I feel very empowered, and I have no apologies about.
Do you recommend the men?
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's so funny because, you know, the person that I get my guns from here in Los Angeles says like every one of his clients at this point is Jews, like especially physicians. So.
Why
I mean,
physicians?
you might think you don't know people that are carrying. You know, I have my carry license in 31 states.
Whoa.
Yeah.
How difficult is it in LA to get a carrying
It
license?
took 9 months. I did it in 21. I've been carrying for over 2 years now.
Interesting. I mean,
Yeah.
I've been carrying mace
Mace is good
and
too. You know, whatever you're comfortable with, but
yeah, no, I
don't
mean,
feel bad
it's
about empowering yourself and learning how to use different tools at your disposal. You know, to me, driving a car, I mean, that's like operating heavy machinery. You can do serious damage with that, but no one thinks twice about that. But for some
Right.
reason, and this is coming from a woman, by the way, who wouldn't let my kids play shooting games on video games. Like,
No,
you know,
but I
after
understand.
I
Is it
started getting threats after 21, I was
there?
like,
There's a
this is
yeah, but
crazy.
there's a difference between those two things. There are a lot of studies that link kids being obsessed with, violence and video games with some pretty bad behavior when they grow up. and defending and carrying a gun to defend yourself. I mean,
no, I know, but I'm just letting you know, like, for me, like, guns were not on my radar, and I actually, like, was avoiding them even in video games for my kids. Like, it wasn't like that I'm like, oh yeah, you know, I grew up in Texas and guns were in our house all the time. Like, absolutely not. If you would have asked me 5 years ago, I would have been like, what are you talking about? But at this point, you know, I had a pig's hoof sent to my office from New Jersey. I've had threats left on voicemail. I've had threats on social media. And so I have friends in the criminal threats unit in the LAPD. I have friends in the FBI, and I carry. So, I mean, I think to me, it would be unintelligent not to.
Yeah, I'm wondering what people are thinking about listening to this right now.
I think the point is, like, whether, you know, the point is that they're listening and that we need to listen to each other.
And the synagogue where MGE is based, I don't know if you know much about Manhattan Jewish Experience, we're for 20s and 30s, less affiliated, but we rent space from a 100-year-old synagogue called the Jewish Center, which is on West 86th Street.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're like, it's like a big bullseye. I mean, I hate to say it. And, you know, the congregation was very reluctant. They have always had security, but they've been reluctant to have a person with a gun. And I remember, I was like, what are they going to do, throw the walkie-talkie at the guy? You need to have a gun. And they beefed up since October 7th a lot more. But I also started offering, not that I teach it, but we host Krav Maga classes. And I think it's a whole mentality.
Why don't you host some shooting courses?
Who's that?
Take your congregation shooting.
Right. So that's like, it's so beyond the culture
it's
like
so funny because in LA, everyone's doing it now. I feel like New York is like 20% behind LA as far as like politics and like the change, shift. They're like 20% behind.
Right.
Here, it's like every, you know, my congregation has been guarded by armed guards as far as I can remember. They're ex-military, their ex-Navy, their ex-IDF, guarding our synagogue for as long as I can remember, like decades.
Yeah. Have you heard of CSS? I don't know. CSS, it's bigger on the East Coast. Community, I don't know. It's a volunteer community security in addition to the armed guards, because it just creates more deterrence. And it's another layer of, like, you know, and it's all, we've trained about 5 or 6 CSS professionals, and they just stand at the door downstairs, or they're on the 10th floor where MGE is, to make sure that, you know, it's just additional. And it's also a very empowering thing, because people just are watching, you know. But American Jews relative to Israeli Jews are, I don't want to call us wusses, but like, we're definitely
It is. It's wussy. It's very snowflakey. Like, my friends in you know, in Israel, they take turns. Who's going to carry the gun to synagogue this week? Like, they're all trained. I think that we just need to be trained. I think be political. It needs to be about personal safety. And it needs to be about being realistic. You know, a Persian Jewish dentist who we know was murdered in San Diego.
I know.
Like, this is real, guys. Like, you know, what has to happen for you to wake up further? Like, does somebody on the East Coast need to get killed too? Like, what needs to happen? You tell me.
Yeah. Well, we just had a vandal a couple of blocks from here on the West Side. It was just another vandalized Israeli-owned shop. We appreciate your voice, Sheila.
I don't know what else to say.
No, it's important. And I think one of the reasons I wanted to have you on, not only because you're a really articulate defender of Israel, but I want my listeners to hear someone whose family left Persia, who left Iran, or Russians who are second generation. It's not a Sephardi versus Ashkenazic thing as much as we've been here for 4 or 5 generations and it's been so sweet and nice. And we don't have any historical context. I'm going to just share another book that I've been reading. It's called The Pity of It All. I don't know if you've heard of this book. It is dense, but it's a really important read. It's about 250 years of Jewish contribution to German culture leading up to the Second World War.
Wow.
And I don't know if you're aware, there was a book that many of the intellectual Jews of pre-war Germany had, like, an entry of all of the different scientists, politicians, university professors, attorneys that contributed to Jewish culture in a significant way. You're talking, you know, Albert Einstein, Niels Bohr, like, and it was 1,000 pages, and it was done ostensibly to, you know, call the dogs off, basically. And it didn't matter. It didn't matter. And if you don't study, and if you're not aware of those types of things, like, I know it because my grandmother, blessed memory, I spent a lot of time with her when I was a kid. She was from Germany, and my mother was born in Liechtenstein because they escaped Germany and they lived near Switzerland, a little tiny country called Liechtenstein, until they came to the United States. And if you don't grow up hearing these things, they don't sound real to you. And you grow up in America and you're in this kind of bubble. And yeah, there were Persians who came here. They had some revolution, but it's not your reality. Even if they're your patients or they're your friends, it didn't happen to them or to their parents. So that was one of the main reasons, honestly, I was interested, because I want people to hear, you know, the perspective of someone who had to flee another country.
And I just want to give a caveat to what you just said, too. Things happen little by little. Things happen inch by inch. And I think the caveat to listening to your grandma's Holocaust stories or the Ashkenazi Jews remembering, you know, the Holocaust, but maybe it didn't affect them, but they, you know, still carry those stories. Things don't have to be the Holocaust to be offensive. Mm-hmm. A swastika on a desk is offensive. It's enough for you to be pissed off and get loud. You know, it doesn't have to be, oh, the Holocaust. One missile coming into Israel is enough.
Yeah.
To be pissed off. It doesn't matter if the Iron Dome caught it or not. And so I think the mistake in the mentality of Ashkenazi Jews too is that they hold everything in standard to the Holocaust. And we should,
if it doesn't, if it doesn't rise. And that's why people are exercised, because October 7th, it really sort of got up there.
But why? Why did that happen? You know, did it happen?
Because we've developed a tolerance, an inappropriate tolerance for anti-Semitism. That's why.
Pushback.
And the great desire of the Jew to be loved by his neighbors is as old as Judaism is. We love to be loved, and
miss out on that part?
I don't know. Listen, I used to talk to my grandmother of blessed memory about, it was very painful. She had a very hard time talking about, she always used to speak about Hitler Youth and the Nazi Party. But she would make that distinction between the Nazis and her German friends, because she couldn't handle.
Yeah.
She couldn't psychologically, emotionally handle that German society turned against the Jew. And we know that that was the case. It wasn't the Nazi Party. And we know that it's not simply Hamas. Okay.
It's not. Thank you for saying that.
I mean, it doesn't mean every Palestinian hates Jews. It doesn't mean that. But to just say that it's confined to Hamas, I mean, we know what happened.
You know, there's studies that came out right now. There's studies. We have studies. We have opinion polls, you know, and maybe 5% don't agree with what happened on October 7th.
Yeah,
we cannot make peace with 5% when 95% supported October 7th. We can't make peace with 5%. And you know, I'm a physician. You have to make the correct diagnosis to apply the proper treatment. I can't give blood pressure medication to a diabetic and hope their diabetes goes away. We have to stop being snowflakes. We have to stop misdiagnosing. We have to speak in fact, and we have to speak in truth.
I want to ask you one last question. I know you're not living in Israel, but if you were living in Israel, and this is a difficult question, okay? But you don't seem to have a problem with difficult questions. If you were living in Israel and you were a physician in a hospital, and a terrorist was shot, and he was brought into the hospital.
Here. You know how many people I've had to help that had Nazi tattoos on their eyelids and on their tongue, like inside of their lips?
What's your thinking about that?
To save the world to save one is to save the world entire. You know, I help. I don't make judgments. When a life is in danger, you help that human.
Even if you knew, even if the guy came with something wrapped in his toe, you know, Hamas terrorist who killed X amount, and you know that when he goes to jail, when he gets out, you would still treat him.
Absolutely.
Let me hear why.
Because I'm a physician and I treat a human in need. And I think people can be changed. And, you know, he can serve his imprisonment. He can serve his time, but I am not God. I am not one to choose who lives and who dies.
Okay, I hear you. That's a solid argument. That's a solid argument because it's, you know, the guy who perpetrated October 7th, the mastermind.
I know. He had a brain tumor. Yeah.
And we fixed him.
Shouldn't
And we
have let
put.
him out, though. That's the thing. They shouldn't have let him out.
Right. Right. Thank you so much, Dr. Sheila Nazarian. Did I pronounce your name right?
You did. You did great.
Okay. Thank you so much. If anybody wants to continue to follow you, what do they do? Where, how do they do
I'm
this?
on Instagram, Dr. Sheila Nazarian. I'm on X at Dr. Nazarian. I am prolifically writing articles all the time. So you can just search my name and you'll find me everywhere.
Awesome. Thank you so much for coming on. And Shem should bless your work and your continued defense of the people in the state of Israel. I really appreciate your time and the work you're doing. Kol kavod.
Thank you. You too.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so
All
much.
right. Have a
Take
good
care.
one.